It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tree sap is flowing through maple trees across Wisconsin with ideal weather conditions that spell good news for harvesters and for those of us with a sweet spot for maple syrup. Today, a look at how maple syrup is produced. Join in by calling with your questions or comments about maple syrup, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Teresa Barone is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. Teresa and her family own Maple Sweet Dairy and Maple Buzz in De Pere with 1,200 taps. Teresa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Teresa, 1,200 taps, that is a lot. How do you manage?
We have a big family. Like many maple operations throughout the state, they are run by a lot of family businesses. Maple syrup is one of those cool businesses that brings people and families together.
Well, the maple syrup season is here in Wisconsin, and you started setting up your taps already in February. How's the season going so far?
The season here in De Pere is running like crazy. We've been cooking since the February 20th. In the month of March so far, we've only cooked, or we've cooked every day except 2 days.
Is that unusual?
Weather has been, no, it's Mother Nature's, what do I always say, Mother Nature's season. Last year, we were cooking on the 27th of March started. This year, it just started a lot earlier.
So, the maple syrup season varies in Wisconsin. So, what does the temperature have to be? Like, what are the perfect conditions that make you say, yep, it's time to start tapping those trees?
Ideal temperatures would be that 20 at night and above freezing during the day. So, that 35, 36 and sunny helps the tree sap flow.
We're talking about Wisconsin's maple syrup season with Teresa Barone, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. How many producers are in the association? Is it all big businesses or some smaller ones as well?
We have a wide range. We have about 350 members, anywhere from 30,000 taps to one tap.
Really? So even somebody who just has one tap can be part of that association?
Yes.
On average, how much maple syrup does Wisconsin produce?
Last year, they made, according to the NAS stats, 440,000 gallons of maple syrup.
Wow.
This is a little skewed number because not everybody reports their what they make. So I would think that number is probably another 100 to 200,000 gallons.
How does that compare? How does that compare to past seasons?
So in 2020, it was about an 18% from the season before.
Have the number of taps increased as well?
Yeah. So in 2021, the taps increased, or 22, sorry, in tap by taps increased by about 30,000. A lot more hobbyists are starting out tapping a few trees in their yard so they can make their own little product.
I'm curious how Wisconsin compares to other producing states. I confess I get a little miffed when I see Vermont as this, you know, big maple syrup producer, but I suppose they are the top of the pile, aren't they?
Wisconsin is fourth in the nation in maple syrup production. Vermont is first, followed by New York, followed by Maine, and then comes Wisconsin.
I never think about New York as being a maple syrup producer, but you're right. Yes. So do you see the number of maple syrup producers in Wisconsin growing or shrinking? Is this something that people are getting more involved in?
I see it growing. Over the last few years, industry has grown quite a few more producers.
I'm curious about climate change and the effects of that. How is your own business adapting to the effects of climate change on maple syrup production?
Climate change, it seems that our seasons are getting earlier and earlier, just even throughout the state. And I say that this year it's kind of skewed because up in northern Wisconsin, a lot of producers have not personally started cooking yet just because of the weather, the huge snowfalls and the cold temps up there.
Sure. In northern Wisconsin, I mean, there's still a lot of snow up there. So What about in the southern parts of the state? Did they start even earlier than you, or was February about it?
Southern part of the state started about a week earlier than us. Some producers have stopped tapping down there. By us in De Pere on Saturday, we had 14 and a half inches that put a little damper on the collecting method in our sugar bush, just more snow. But up north, I've heard they have anywhere to 2 to 3 feet of snow in the woods.
Yes, yes. It's hard to imagine when you're in an area of the state that doesn't have that much snow that there really is that much. But, you know, circling back to the climate change and environmental issues, do you see ways that maple syrup farmers can reduce their environmental impact or pollution?
I do. People can switch evaporator systems from going wood to natural gas or propane evaporators. Now there has been electric evaporators have come out, and actually new to the industry. I shouldn't say new, but there's steam evaporators. So that helps out with the emission not being as much as you're evaporating. With maple syrup, you're evaporating, you know, 2% sugar to the water. So when you're making 40-1, all that evaporation of water. So that helps out with the emissions.
Well, we'll delve into the processes involved in a little bit more detail when we're back in a minute with the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association Executive Director, Teresa Barham. You can be part of our conversation as well by calling in with your questions or your thoughts about maple syrup, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Teresa Barone is a maple syrup farmer with 1,200 taps in eastern Wisconsin and executive director of the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. Call with questions about maple syrup or your favorite ways to use it, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Teresa, take me through it. Walk us through maple syrup production. How does this all work, start to finish?
So you want to start tapping your trees in the spring time of the year. You want your tree to be a maple tree, either a sugar maple, silver maple, or red maple. You want that tree to be at least 10 inches in diameter at breast height. So what you do is you go out, you tap that tree about an inch and a half into the tree because that is where your sap is being made. You tap it in, you put a little spigot in, and you pound that spigot in. And then you put a food-grade container of some kind, pail, bag, and cover on, and wait for that sap to drip.
I'm curious about the tools that you need to do the tapping. What exactly do you use to tap the tree?
So you would need a drill bit, anywhere from 5/16 to 7/16, depending on what size spigot you're putting in, a hammer, and a pail. Do they make special equipment? Yes, they do, but you can use a normal 5/16 bit. The ones made for tapping help out clean the hole better. Usually you use a smaller hammer, but you can use a regular hammer. And you pound that spigot in until it has a hollow sound, and then you hang your pail or bag on it. One thing about whatever you're putting sap is a perishable product, and it'll take up the taste of any container you put that sap into. So you want to make sure it's a clean container, washed without warm water so you're not getting the soap residue because the sap would pick up that.
And should it be plastic or metal or glass? Does it matter?
It doesn't matter. Sometimes the problem with glass is with the freeze cycle, because sap will freeze, it can break your glass container.
Oh, sure. Well, how much sap does it take to make a gallon of syrup? Is it a lot?
Yes, it takes about 40 gallons or 42 gallons to make 1 gallon of syrup, depending on your sugar content of the sap.
So if I'm at my house and I and I want to tap my tree, I mean, that sounds like a lot. Am I going to get that much out of one tree?
Yeah. So on average, one tree, one tap hole will give you about 12 gallons of sap on a good year, which in hindsight will make a quart of maple syrup.
We're talking about maple syrup production with Teresa Barone, Executive Director of Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. If people want to tap their own trees, can they tap on public lands or does it have to be on your own property?
When it comes to public lands, you need to ask your county or your state on that.
Okay.
You can't just go out and tap on public land.
I can't just go to the park in my neighborhood and
no.
Okay.
Or go down the city and tap all the city streets. No.
Come on now. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah. There has been producers that have, and they have actually had to pull their taps. So you really need to make sure if you're tapping on public land, you're getting proper permission from whoever owns that land.
Good advice there. Well, for a beginner, what's the most challenging part of producing maple syrup? What's the hardest thing for people to master?
I think the boiling down, because it takes a lot of time to boil that sap down. And again, like the sap in a food-grade container, when you're boiling down, that sap takes on the taste. So if, say, I'm putting my sap in a turkey fryer, you just got to make sure you use a clean pan when you're doing that. Otherwise, it would take on the oils of that turkey fryer.
So let's talk about that then. So I mean, you tap the trees, you get the sap, and then what, you just boil it and it turns into syrup, or is there something else that happens?
You just boil and boil and boil. One thing cool about maple syrup, it really is just the sap from the tree. It is a natural product. There's nothing else added to it. If you ever buy a bottle in the store and it has any other ingredient in it, it's not pure maple syrup.
How is that maple sugar candy made? My mom loves that stuff.
So maple syrup candy is made by you. Take that syrup after your finished product and you cook it up to 234
okay.
degrees and you cook it. And then it hardens and there's your maple candy. There again, nothing in it besides maple syrup.
It's so yummy. Again, we're learning about maple syrup production with Teresa Barone, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. Is there a way to know whether a tree will be a good producer of sap before you tap into it?
Usually a tree on a lawn is going to be a very good producer because there's no other trees competing against it. And again, you want a healthy tree. You don't want a tree that's dying. The healthier your tree, the better sap you should get from that tree. A sugar maple usually has a higher sugar content in the sap compared to your red or silver maple, mm-hmm. but you can tap any of those maples in that maple family.
How come it's just the spring season? I mean, it just seems to be such a short window of opportunity to get that sap. Is that the only time sap is running?
Yeah, it's that freeze-thaw cycle. That's what you really need to produce higher amounts of sap.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about the grades of syrup. I see this at the grocery store or I see it at the farmer's market, and I don't really know what they mean. Four different grades. What are the grades, and how does that affect the flavor?
So the grades are golden, delicate, amber, dark, and very dark. Usually at the beginning of the season, you get your more golden. Towards the end, you get the very dark. A few years ago, they changed the grading system. So you usually will not find grade B. Grade B has kind of been changed to very dark. Usually the darker the syrup, the more robust taste you get.
Like more of a maple taste or is it just like thicker?
More of the maple taste.
Okay. So is that considered better? The very dark stuff, is that considered better than the lighter golden stuff?
Most people tend to like the amber.
Okay.
They like the amber on their palate. Through the years, the dark and very dark have become, more people are tending to like that more because they like the strong taste. But when it comes to pancakes, most people like that amber maple syrup on the pancakes. And color can change because of many things, too. It can change, I shouldn't say light to, or beginning to later season. It can change from your cooking process. It can change if you're using RO. There are many changes that can change that color.
Well, obviously, we put syrup on our pancakes. But what are some of your favorite ways to use syrup? I mean, what are some of the other uses that you, what do you put it in?
Many people use it to make old fashions. A maple old fashioned has many local bars and supper clubs you'll see throughout the state of Wisconsin are starting to put it in there. Salad dressings, it can be used for such a wide range of things. People are starting to infuse it with vanilla, cinnamon. Those have been just a change to the maple up, a little change in the flavor.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and ice cream. A lot of people love maple syrup on ice cream. It's a great treat for the kids.
I never thought about that. Yeah. That my husband puts it in his banana bread, and I mean, just as a sweetener. So good. Maple syrup is so labor intensive. I mean, why should people use maple syrup rather than other alternatives on the market, like corn syrup or honey or the imitation stuff?
So maple syrup actually, 2 tablespoons equals the same potassium as a banana. Maple syrup is very high in nutrients and a sweetener that can be substituted for your sugars.
So I can say it's better, it's good for me?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, good. That's a really good excuse to use it. I'm curious about the cost of it. I mean, is it costs so much at the grocery store when you're buying a gallon of maple syrup. Why is that?
Well, as you know, maple syrup is very labor intensive. So when you're thinking 40 gallons of sap to make a gallon of syrup, average throughout the state is anywhere from, I'd say, 16 to 20, some people 25. Really, as like everything with the supply chain, the maple syrup bottles have went up tremendously. Your equipment has gone up. So for people to compensate for all those costs.
How do maple syrup factories produce maple syrup in bulk? I mean, do corporations like have thousands of trees to make it in bulk, or I mean, how does that work?
So there are all different size producers and all different concepts of it. There's some commercial packers in Wisconsin that just buy their syrup and then pack it. There's some producers that have that 30,000-40,000 taps that have a bottling system and bottle their syrup and sell it, the stuff that you see in the grocery store. But one thing cool about Wisconsin grocery stores, they reach out to all size producers on that store shelf.
So we'll often see your things and the things from your company right in the store shelves too, then I would imagine. But do you remember getting started in this as a child? I mean, is this something that was part of your life for your whole life, or did you come into it later?
I started as a child. I have 10 brothers and sisters. My parents had a dairy farm. This was kind of like our off-season thing. As our family grew, we got more and more taps. We started with about 50 taps, and now we have 1,200 taps. So it's kind of been a labor of love in our family, bringing brothers and sisters, family, friends together, and it still does today as the operation has grown.
I grew up with real maple syrup. We always had it on the table, and my son doesn't like it. I think there's something wrong with him. Is there anyone in your family who says, you know what, maple syrup isn't for me?
Well, when we were kids, we had lots of it. So, yes, there's a few family members just because of the overconsumption we had when we were little.
I would imagine. What about you, though? I mean, is it still something you like despite all of the consumption you've had of it over the years? Is it still something that you love to have on your table?
It is. It's on our breakfast table every morning. It's in our coffee. You know, it's in your ice cream at night. It really is something we use as a substitute for sugar.
You put it in your coffee, too?
Yep, it tastes great in coffee.
All right.
Because it's sweetener.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to try that tomorrow morning for sure. Thank you so much for being here and sharing this with us. We really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Teresa Barron is the executive director of the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association. Teresa and her family own Maple Sweet Dairy and Maple Buzz in De Pere. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. The Federal Trade Commission is proposing to eliminate non-compete agreements or contracts stipulating that employees cannot leave a job and work for competitors within a specified region. We learn more about this proposal, and you can be part of the conversation by calling in with your questions or thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martin Genko is a professor in the Department of Management and Human Resources at UW-Madison's Business School and academic director of the university's Weinert Center for Entrepreneurship. Martin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
The Federal Trade Commission is proposing to ban employers from including non-compete clauses in employment contracts. First, I'd like to ask you why these clauses are used and what they're meant to accomplish when employers use them.
Thank you. So these clauses are used quite frequently, and they're used to restrict workers from usually joining competing workers, competing companies. And kind of the logic is here that the companies want to protect their intellectual property or trade secrets and want to maybe increase their incentives in their human capital. So the idea is to somewhat improve their returns on these investments. However, they, as we know now, there's lots of research that these non-competes are used very broadly, even against workers who should not be, you know, the original design of the law was not intended to be used for those kind of workers.
What kind of workers do you mean when you say that the type of workers that are not really meant for that type of situation?
Yeah. So, for instance, workers who are hourly or low-paid workers, we know that about, on average, we have about 10% of workers who are lower skilled or lower paid are subject to non-compete. So these workers are typically not holding any intellectual property or trade secrets, and yet again, they are restricted from joining other firms that would be maybe in the same geographical area and in the same industry. And we also know that it has negative impact on their wages.
How do we know that there's a negative impact on those wages?
So there's quite a bit of research now where we have sort of studied non-competes. We have about a decade of research on non-competes, and it's becoming really evident that the negative impact on wages is there, in particular for these lower wage and lower skilled jobs.
And when we're talking about a non-compete, do they typically specify a certain amount of time, like for a year you can't go work somewhere else, or is it a far-reaching amount of time?
Yep. So these they do vary. So they vary in their restrictiveness. There's also a lot of variation across states, but typically they do restrict a mobility or joining a competing firm over a certain period. It's either could be 6 months or even a year in some cases. That is correct.
We're talking about non-compete restrictions with Wisconsin School of Business professor Martin Genko. According to the Federal Trade Commission, an estimated one in every five American workers has signed one of these types of clauses. So they're in widespread use across many industries and binding on both high and low wage workers. But how are they actually enforced?
Yep. So they tend to be enforced in court. Of course, they are one of those, you know, one of the reasons why the firms are willing to use them very frequently and why they're used, why there's such a widespread use, because they are tend to be more, maybe it's cheaper, it tends to be cheaper to enforce them in court compared to some other intellectual property litigation, such as enforcing patents or maybe enforcing other forms of intellectual property such as trade secrets. And the reason is because the violations tend to be you know, readily observable, and sort of that's why it's there maybe easier to be enforced in courts.
What about when a worker quits their job and takes a similar job in another state? Does that make it harder to enforce because of the differences in state laws and enforceability?
Yeah, so that is a very good question, and I'm not a legal scholar, so mm-hmm. I study more the implications of non-competes on firms and on regions and also strategies of firms, you know, how they're using, you know, what are some maybe some reasons for firms to use or not use these non-competes. But it tends to be the case that it may become harder to enforce when workers are moving across state boundaries, and especially if they're moving into a state which is not enforcing non-competes, such as from Wisconsin, let's say, to California, that has banned the enforcement of non-competes.
The Federal Trade Commission says non-competes are an unfair method of competition. They're also saying that it could potentially violate the 1914 Federal Trade Commission Act. What are your thoughts on that? Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and I think it's a very good effort that the FTC is now trying to accomplish. And yeah, I think I completely. We have, again, quite a bit of research discussing the overall negative implications of non-competes on mobility and sort of vibrancy of labor markets and wages. And as I said, especially for lower skilled jobs, there is, you know, the effect is quite negative. So we know that, you know, banning non-competes would improve the overall economy, both at the regional level, and there's also effects on entrepreneurship. For instance, the likelihood of people leaving and starting companies will increase if we do not have non-compete. So in general, they are, when we are thinking about implications for regions and for, you know, innovativeness and outcomes like that, the non-competes do have a negative impact.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about how the non-compete clauses could affect the American economy. Everybody's thinking about the economy right now. So if we ban these things, what kinds of positive impact would it have? Would it affect the prices of products, for example?
So that is a good question. And in general, we may expect, again, easier mobility of workers across jobs. It will be much easier for them to maybe negotiate wages, and will be wage increases. It also, you know, in terms of the outcomes, in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation, there has been research done on, for instance, spillover. So there's more knowledge flowing across organizations, and this may help maybe companies coming up with new ideas. And again, it may be easier to start a company and assemble a founding team, and that may lead to new services, the new products being introduced, and so on. So there may be an overall effect on the economy, and you know, we may expect that, again, it may have a positive impact on consumers at the end of the day as well.
Some companies do avoid imposing non-compete agreements on the people they hire. Why do you think they do that? Avoid it. I mean, they think, nope, I'm not going to do it. Why would that be?
Yep, that's a very good question. So this is some of the research that I have been doing recently. And what we're finding is that some companies find it beneficial to sort of opt themselves out of the non-compete use. And one of the downsides, even for companies using non-competes is, on one hand, they are able to retain workers and restrict their mobility and make them sort of more captive. But on the other hand, the downside of using non-competes is that their ability to attract highly skilled and highly talented workers may decrease as well. So what we're finding in this research is that some companies are willingly opting out of the non-compete use, and they may even advertise it. They may put it in there on their website, and they may put it on when they are posting their jobs. They may say, "We're not using non-competes because we want our workers to be joining our company and staying here because they want to, and they don't necessarily have to." So there are some companies, and I think this trend is increasing, especially in some industries where some companies are just willingly opting out of the non-compete use.
Are there industries in which companies are more likely to opt out of using non-compete restrictions, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
Yeah, so what we're finding is that it's especially in industries where the competition for talent is very intense, and these are companies that are maybe still need that talent for their competitive advantage. So this again may be more happening in industries which are relying on workers with sort of higher human capital. And again, this is why non-competes or banning non-competes is so important in these lower skilled jobs, because there this incentive may not be not as pronounced. So that's why these negative effects could play out more dramatically. Yeah, so there is a lots of variation across industries.
I'm curious about whether or not, especially young people who are new to the professional workforce, if they really understand the impact of a non-compete when they take that job. They graduate from school, they get their first job, and they think, well, it's got a non-compete, big deal. Do you think that they understand the risks involved and the ramifications of what they're signing?
That's an excellent question. So we also have some research showing that many workers do not know what they're signing, and they may not necessarily understand all of the implications. And this is something which I also, when I talk to my students, is very frequently they are focused very much on getting that first job and getting the paycheck and, being able to find a good employer, but they're not always thinking about the next job and the following job. So thinking about the entire career is quite important, and they sometimes do not necessarily pay attention to that. And at the same time, we also have research saying that people are not paying attention to non-competes, and they don't exactly know what they're signing. And when it comes to the moment they want to leave and maybe join a competing firm, their employer tells them that they have signed a non-compete, and it comes as a surprise. So that's why I think the current, I think, effort from the FTC is also important, because it's raising awareness, and people are starting to talk about these things more and more, and I think workers will be more aware of what they're signing.
We're examining the use of non-compete agreements by employers as the Federal Trade Commission proposes eliminating them. Martin Genko is a professor in the Department of Management and Human Resources at the Wisconsin School of Business. Call in at any time with your questions or thoughts about non-compete agreements, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. The Federal Trade Commission is gathering public comment on a proposed ban of non-compete agreements. Are you an employer with concerns about the FTC's proposed ban? Or as an employee, have you ever signed one? Call in with your questions or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martin Genko is a professor in the Department of Management and Human Resources at the Wisconsin School of Business, and he stays with us. We have Matt from Green Bay on the line with us. Matt, hi. Thanks for calling.
Great show and excellent topic. Quick question for you. I thought I heard that does Wisconsin enforce non-compete clauses in contracts, or do they not allow them?
Martin?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
So Wisconsin does enforce non-competes. It is allowed here.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you for the question, Matt. We're glad to clarify that. Some states do have bans. You mentioned California earlier. So which states do have bans?
Correct. There are some states that have bans. There are some states that have complete bans. And then there are some states that have some carve-outs for certain types of workers. So California, North Dakota, Oklahoma are states that are not enforcing. Then we have a few other states. I think Washington, D.C. is another state that is recently not enforcing. And then we have some states that have carve-outs for certain type of workers. For instance, Oregon is not enforcing for low-skilled and low-wage jobs.
So if the FTC rule becomes final, then that reaches over all the state stuff, right? I mean, the state stuff doesn't matter.
Well, so that's of course a very important question, but we are expecting a significant pushback from some of the states. So we have kind of other states on the other side of the spectrum that are enforcing non-competes and are very strong in their enforcement. For instance, Florida is an example that has a very strong enforcement of non-competes. So there are expectations of some legal pushback from these states, and it's not clear what the outcome is. And most likely the rule will be preliminary for a while, and during that time there will be some litigation and there will be some legal pushback from the states. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, even if the FTC ruling is issued, that this will be the end of the non-competes, and most likely it will not be the case, at least not immediately.
In the states that ban non-competes with restrictions on some workers, how are workers faring in those states? Do you know?
Yep, that's also very interesting. So for instance, we have some research showing that even in these states where non-competes are not enforceable, many companies are still incorporating non-competes in their contracts. And I think they're essentially relying on workers not being informed and not knowing that these non-competes are not enforceable in these states. And they're hoping that they will behave based on, you know, consistently with that clause. And that's why I think raising awareness and providing more information about these non-competes is more important. But in general, we know that workers in these states, there is more mobility, and the workers benefit from not having to sign non-competes in those states.
Do you ever see a situation in which non-compete clauses do make sense? For example, company leaders, CEOs, to protect corporate privacy, do those kinds of non-compete clauses make sense, or in any other case?
Yes, that's a very good question. So the argument that companies are making, that non-competes are very important for them to retain their intellectual property. And we see even though some evidence is still mixed, there is some evidence that for instance, top managers and very, very highly skilled workers, at least in some cases, the non-competes could make sense because these intellectual property considerations do apply. So if there is a category of workers where maybe sort of ruling out non-competes would potentially make sense, I would say maybe top managers are one of those possibilities. And again, we have some emerging evidence that in those cases, the wage effects are actually positive. So, and it could be because top managers and executives, they know what they're signing. And it's essentially, it's a trade. So on one hand, they may be signing a non-compete. On the other hand, they may be getting compensated for it. So in those cases, we see that the wage effects are not necessarily negative. And there is some mixed evidence on this, but it is possible that for certain types of workers, it does not have a negative effect on wages.
We're talking about non-compete restrictions with Wisconsin School of Business professor Martin Genko. The Federal Trade Commission says its proposed rule banning non-competes would leave unchanged other employment restrictions. Another common restriction on workers, non-disclosure agreements. How are non-compete clauses and non-disclosure agreements different from one another?
Yes. So non-disclosure agreements are, of course, separate, and they're typically used to also protect intellectual property. So what we know is that many companies are using NDA separately. However, we also know that many companies are using these restrictions in bundles. And this is not only non-disclosure agreements, but there's other types of restrictions as well, such as non-poaching and non-solicitation agreements. And these type of clauses are used to restrict workers from taking customers with them when they leave and recruiting their coworkers when they move across companies. And the research is showing that companies that are using non-compete agreements tend to use these other restrictions in bundles. So companies that are using their overall, so some companies have a much more proactive, let's say, strategy towards protecting intellectual property. They would use all of these clauses in their employment contract as a bundle. And it is possible that if FTC rule goes through and the non-compete agreements will become non-enforceable, that the companies will rely more on these other types of restrictions. But because non-competes tend to be a very blunt instrument, because they're restricting workers from just joining, you know, competitors in a certain area over a certain time, it's very likely that these other restrictions will not have even if companies will end up relying more on them, there will be still positive effect on workers.
In December, President Joe Biden signed legislation that curbed the use of confidentiality agreements that prevent victims of sexual harassment from speaking publicly. Do you have a sense of whether Congress and Biden support limiting the use of non-compete clauses? What is the buzz that you're hearing?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So my sense, the administration is supportive and would like to ban non-compete use. And I think this is consistent with this FTC rule as well. But of course, it remains to be seen. And ideally, this would have to be enacted as a new law by the Congress. It remains to be seen if this is something which will be on the agenda and will be able to, you know, occur. However, if it just becomes an FTC rule, then, as I said, it's unclear what the final outcome will be because of the resulting pushback from various states that are enforcing right now these non-competes.
Yes, you said that the new rule is likely to be challenged in court in a number of states. April 19th is the deadline to submit public comments on the Federal Trade Commission's proposed ban. When do you think a decision will come down?
That's a good question. I am not sure. We'll see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all of this information. We truly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Martin Genko is a professor in the Department of Management and Human Resources at UW-Madison's Business School and the academic director of the university's Weinert Center for Entrepreneurship. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.